It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a guest says big agricultural companies are making it hard for Wisconsin farmers to turn a profit.
First, Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn announced this week he's seeking an external review of the city's police force from the U.S. Department of Justice. The announcement came on the same day that federal prosecutors opted not to file criminal civil rights charges against the former Milwaukee police officer who shot and killed Dontre Hamilton last year.
The process that Flynn is seeking, called a collaborative reform initiative, is the same kind of review that took place in the wake of the events in Ferguson, Missouri. Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn joins us now to talk more about why he's seeking the review and how it'll work if it gets approval. Chief Flynn, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you. It's nice to be here.
So right off the bat, I would like to ask you, why are you seeking this review from the U.S. Department of Justice?
Well, you know, there's some background here. The Department of Justice Criminal Division decided not to charge former Officer Manny with any violations of federal law related to the death of Dontre Hamilton. As I've said many times before, losing a loved one to violence, including at the hands of the police, is a terrible tragedy, and I've got no doubt that Mr. Hamilton's families continue to both grieve as well as feel frustrated by what they perceive as a unresponsive criminal justice system. Keep in mind, I fired the officer for violations of policy, as he had been trained in how to handle the mentally ill, and his initial misjudgment set in process a chain of events that placed him in a situation in which, in fact, his use of deadly force was necessary and certainly was well within both state and federal statutes. But I held him accountable for his initial decisions. Now, what we have done since then is develop very aggressive training about critical crisis intervention training. We've worked very hard to develop a model unique to Milwaukee, where we'll be the only department with everyone trained in CIT. And the background is, for 8 years, this police department has been engaged in a series of progressive reforms, and we've made significant progress. Our uses of force have declined every year. Our citizen complaints have declined every year. And just earlier this week, we were accredited by the Wisconsin Law Enforcement Accreditation Group, demonstrating we met over 226 different standards for policy, procedures, operations, and support services. So why am I asking for a collaborative reform agreement? I know how good we are. The data supports us by every objective measure. But the nature of the news business is, of course, to focus on these critical incidents and any form of conflict or perceived conflict between aggrieved individuals and the police department. And I also recognize that there are some segments of the community that are totally unaware of the, you know, larger picture of the state of policing in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. So I decided to ask for collaborative reform. What does that mean? That's a voluntary arrangement with the Justice Department in which they send in subject matter experts to evaluate your organization's policies, procedures, and practices top to bottom. It's voluntary. They will not grant it if they are contemplating suing you for a pattern and practice violation. They will not grant collaborative review to departments that they are considering bringing under a consent decree. I'm confident in our reforms. I am open to suggestion to anything we could do better, but I'm also convinced that a thorough review by a Justice Department that has certainly never shown itself reluctant to sue police departments, I'm convinced a thorough objective review of where we are right now will clearly indicate how much progress we've made.
So actually, the collaborative reform agreement is kind of a middle road option. The family of Dontre Hamilton has repeatedly called for a larger scale pattern and practice investigation, and that is where it would examine the entire department for possible civil rights violations. Why are you opting for the collaborative reform agreement instead?
I want to make it very clear. I'm not opting. Okay, I'm not playing defense here. What I'm telling you is the Justice Department will not consider collaborative reform with an agency that is not always already reforming itself. The Justice Department will not consider collaborative reform for a police department that they believe is a candidate for a consent decree. All right, I want to make that very clear. So this is something I am prospectively asking for. If they're even thinking, or if they think at all, I mean, they're aware of our state of practice here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be just as thorough a review as a pattern and practice review would be, the difference is the following. We're not a candidate for a pattern and practice right now, no matter how much some people would like us to be. All right? That's just objective information. My doing this is saying, listen, I know you're not going to sue us. All right? If you were going to sue us, you would never consider us for this approach. But I'm saying I want to demonstrate to the community we're transparent. We've made enormous progress by any objective standard, and we are open to any suggestion in any venue of something we could do better.
So the collaborative reform agreement is the same process that was requested by St. Louis County Police after the events in Ferguson. That resulted in a 182-page federal report issuing recommendations, but it also did find some serious fault with police practices there. Are you ready to hear whatever the review might find?
Of course I am. But what I'm also saying is that any objective review of this department from the big picture is going to note some pretty significant changes here. Our use of forces has declined significantly over the last 8 years. The University of Wisconsin just did a study of our police department. We had a 22% decrease in uses of force in just the past year. We have very extensive training now on de-escalation training, on crisis intervention training, and on scenario-based use of force training. Our vehicle pursuits have been significantly restricted, have dropped significantly, and practically eliminated injuries to innocent third parties. Our citizen complaints have declined every single year, except one for the last 8 years. They've been on decline for the last 3 years. What I'm saying is a thorough review of this agency is going to find the following. We examined the consent decrees that had already been issued against Pittsburgh and Oakland and Seattle and New Orleans and other cities. And we started aggressively implementing those suggested reforms here years ago before anything dreadful happened in Red Arrow Park a year ago. And so what I'm saying is, yes, we're open to any criticisms, but any objective review of this agency by a disinterested third party is also going to see the things we have done, and other agencies that engage in collaborative reform were not that far down the continuum of positive change as we are.
How is the review actually done? Are there federal officials that come in and actually spend time in the department? Is it mostly looking at, you know, open records, things like that? What are the actual logistics of this kind of review?
They bring in subject matter experts who spend anywhere from 3 to 6 months examining our policies, examining our procedures, examining our training, examining our disciplines, examining our risk management systems, examining the entire way we conduct our business here. And they look for gaps in what would be considered best professional practices. And as I say, if we're missing something, I want to know it. And I don't think anybody else we bring in here will not be deemed credible by somebody. Bringing in the Justice Department is bringing in the people who sue people. So I'm saying, come on in, take a look at us, nothing to hide here. If they grant this thing, I think, it'll make clear that they weren't going to sue us, all right? And that's one of the key issues for me. And the second thing is they're going to find good things. They'll find some gaps, no doubt, and we'll rectify those.
So what response have you been getting from Milwaukee police officers themselves?
Well, they don't feel we've got anything to fear. We just went through a rigorous accreditation process in which we had to meet 226 standards set by the Wisconsin Law Enforcement Accreditation Group. There's only 30 departments in the entire state, which has got, 500 police departments that have achieved that, and none of them are anywhere near the size and complexity of this agency. And they sent a team in here. They went through our policies top to bottom. And what they have to do, we have to be able to prove we're following our policies. We have to have documented proof that if we say we have a policy and procedure on pursuits, we've got to document that we're following it, and so on. And they did a very extensive review here with a very large team because we're an enormous police department. And they were bowled over at all the things we're doing. I mean, if all they knew is what they see on TV, they would think there's all kinds of terrible problems here. But if you look at the overwhelming bulk of the work here, this is a very solid agency that has moved aggressively along the path of reform for 8 years and has actively embraced those suggested reforms the federal government has made in other police departments.
I'm assuming, Chief Flynn, that you are hoping that this will also aid relations between your department and the community as a whole. And as you said, you're confident that the investigation or the report will show a lot that's being done well, but you're also confident that there will be things that are brought to light that need improvement. Are you confident that this report and whatever it ends up saying will help you rebuild and continue to build relationships with the community?
Well, first of all, I object to this notion that the community, in quotes, is some sort of monolith with one opinion. I will tell you right now that we have got the most robust community-based policing strategy in this entire state. And if, you know, you go to any community meeting in our most disadvantaged neighborhoods, you're going to have 50 to 100 people talking about ways they're working collaboratively with the police department. But if I get 25 people standing in the street complaining about how terrible we are, I'll get a news helicopter and four TV stations. All right? Now, we take all of the continuum of opinion in our various communities seriously. But to try to characterize our support in the community as that which is dependent upon the 25 to 30 protesters that show up, you know, once every couple of weeks is wrongheaded. I mean, the fact of the matter is UWM did an extensive citizen-based telephone survey of support for this police department last summer at the height of the Baltimore and Ferguson uproar, as well as uproar here over the Hamilton case. What did they find? You know, they found 75% overall approval rating of this police department in the community of Milwaukee. Now, there was a gap between white and black approval. And unfortunately, African-American approval was only 66%. We want to improve that. But who in government anywhere would not drool at the opportunity to get a two-thirds approval rating from any constituency? So we work hard in those disadvantaged neighborhoods. It's where we're making our maximum efforts to deal with the residual problems of intergenerational poverty, one of which is the biggest disparity in this city is being the victim of a crime. All right, 80% of my homicide victims every year are African-American, 85% of my shooting victims every year are African-American, and we are dialed into those neighborhoods trying to do something about it, working with neighborhood groups, working with non-governmental organizations, and, yes, using data to drive our deployments. So, you know, to characterize our relationship with the community as though, you know, what some people would assert defines our relationships with our many neighborhoods is just wrong. And we take very seriously the opinions of all the folks we have to service. But we also recognize that there's a lot more support out there than we're giving credit for.
Well, Chief Flynn, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Well, thank you for your thoughtful questions.
That was Ed Flynn, Milwaukee Chief of Police. He joined us to talk about his call for a federal review of police practices in Milwaukee. Many Wisconsin farm products have seen a good harvest this year, including a record crop of corn. But there's a downside. The prices for many commodity crops are low, while the cost of products like seeds has gone up, with some premium corn seed prices increasing by 12% each year for the last decade, according to research from Purdue University.
Our next guest says farmers can't get a fair shake, and he says consolidation in the agriculture industry is a big part of that problem. Zach Kernstadt joins us now. He's a government relations associate for the Wisconsin Farmers Union. His opinion piece called Farmers Deserve Better appeared this week in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and other newspapers around the state. Zach, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you write that farmers are in a kind of double bind right now. They've got low prices coming in for the commodities that they sell and high prices for seeds and other key supplies. So how is that crunch playing out for farmers?
Yeah, that's right. Crop farmers in Wisconsin have had a near record, if not a record, harvest this year. And that would really lead one to assume that they also would have had a very profitable year. And that would make sense, right, that they would be profitable. And usually in other situations, other jobs, if someone does their job well, they're rewarded with a raise or extra time off or a promotion. Unfortunately, all too often, the opposite is true in farming, and they're almost penalized for their success. And what I mean by that is that they're really told that in order to achieve success and profitability, increased profitability, they need to accomplish two things. They need to grow more food each year, and they need to grow it more efficiently. And I'd say that the vast majority of farmers do a pretty good job of that. they work hard. They work extremely hard. Some of the farmers I know are some of the hardest workers that I've ever met. They invest in new technologies. They cut costs where they can. And they take other necessary steps to increase their productivity. But we do. We continue to encounter situations like this year where farmers have a near-record harvest, and then they're accompanied by these low commodity prices that barely cover a farmer's cost of production. Now, one of the biggest issues that they're facing and that is bringing the situation on is that we're seeing these prices of agricultural inputs, which, like you mentioned, are things like crop seeds, fertilizer, pesticides, and other agricultural chemicals. We're seeing these agricultural input prices rising much faster than the commodity prices have in the United States.
And you say that ag consolidation is also a big piece of that puzzle. How come? What's happened in recent years?
Well, one of the reasons for these high input costs is that there is this extreme lack of competition in agricultural markets. So we're seeing in the agricultural input market, for instance, we see three firms, Monsanto, DuPont Pioneer, and Syngenta, controlling over half of the global seed market right now. And that's up from 22% in 1996. So as you can see, it's a pretty rapid increase over the past couple of decades. What's more is that these same three firms also control more than one-third of the global pesticide market. Additionally, you will find this similar type of concentration occurring in the ag processing sector. Now, just recently, I think a couple weeks ago, if I'm correct, we saw Cargill's pork unit was purchased by JBS SA. Now, with the approval of that deal, which the United States did approve, more than 70% of the pork processing ability in the U.S. is now controlled by only four companies.
So isn't there an argument there that, that these bigger companies, these bigger farms, and in effect the consolidation that you're talking about, that, that leads to more food productions and maybe at the end of the day better prices for consumers?
That's a possibility. However, what we really are seeing with this consolidation is that there are a small number of firms that essentially have total control over how they want to price these inputs, how they want to price these products. And with that lack of competition, we're seeing raised prices. And I'd say that these issues are really all symptoms of a bigger problem, which is that the current system of agricultural production is really rigged against family farmers. Instead of markets and government policies that help family farmers to thrive as well as these other businesses, we have markets and policies that are really enabling the largest operators, the largest processors, the biggest input manufacturers and crop insurance companies to become even bigger. And the problem is that these firms, they really have everything to gain and nothing to lose from using their power, their wealth, their influence to maintain this current system of agricultural production, which a lot of people kind of refer to it as a get big or get out type of system. And by that, I mean farmers have to continue to adopt these new technologies and continue to fight to increase their production regardless of the demand, which tends to remain relatively inelastic.
And what kind of policies are you talking about that you think set up the system to be rigged against smaller farmers?
Well, some of these policies that I'm talking about what's really needed is we need to level the playing field by pushing for more robust competition in agricultural markets. And the current policies that we're seeing, they don't do a good enough job about doing that. And we can kind of see that from the acquisition of by JBS that I was just referring to. What we really need to see is we need to encourage the federal government to increase and improve these enforcement of these federal antitrust laws. We need some revisions and reforms of existing legislation to really ensure fair market pricing and avoid this non-competitive, monopolistic, or oligopolistic market control. And we can do that by doing a number of things. We can work for changes that really favor sustainable production rather than overproduction. We can also work towards a system that really allows farmers to earn a decent price for the food they grow rather than a system like we have right now, which seems to really prioritize these huge profits for a few big corporations and leave everyone else out to dry.
And if we don't see that kind of change in policy, the kind of policies leaning maybe toward antitrust, monopolistic, as you said, what do you think is at stake? What happens?
Well, there's a lot at stake. One of the big issues that we're seeing right now is that young farmers are having a really difficult time getting into farming. There's a number of reasons for that. First of all, existing farmers are going out of business and having to sell their land to these bigger groups. But the other concern is that farmland rental is, the prices of farmland to rent have been increasing for quite a while. And the concern is that, you know, these beginning farmers can't get into farming, and we are seeing the average age of a farmer increasing every year. Right now, the average age is 58. It's climbing. And we need to fight for these more reasonable regulations in order to make sure that we have farmers 10, 15 years down the road.
Zach, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
That was Zach Hernstadt, Government Relations Associate for the Wisconsin Farmers Union.
In the United States, public policy discussions often come down to trying to find a balance between advocating for what is good for society as a whole and the rights of individuals. Add in industries that have a lot to lose with regulation, and it becomes even harder to reach consensus.
Guns and tobacco are two examples of those debates that happen with strong feelings and interests on all sides. But tackling the impact of the food and beverage industry isn't far behind. Whether it's banning trans fats or limiting how big a soda can be, do these efforts go too far? Are in limiting personal choice in the pursuit of public health.
Joining us to discuss the efforts to educate the public about the harm associated with soft drink consumption and why the tide may be turning is Marion Nessel. She's a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and a professor of sociology at New York University. Her most recent book is Soda Politics: Taking on Big Soda and Winning. Marion, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, glad to be there.
So, Marion, how big is the soft drink industry in the United States?
Oh, it's absolutely enormous. It's dominated by Coca-Cola and PepsiCo. Those are the big ones, with Dr. Pepper Snapple running a third. And they bring in billions of dollars a year in profits, and they sell billions of sodas a year, every day, actually. The amount of soda that's sold is staggering. Americans consume about 30 gallons a year per capita, and half the population doesn't drink them. So that means everybody else is drinking a lot more.
So you said an average of 30 gallons of soda per
person. Well, it's actually about 1 12-ounce can, somewhere between 10 and 12 ounces a day per person. And that's per capita, men, women, and little tiny babies. And if half the population doesn't drink that much every day, that means the other half is drinking twice as much. So average consumption for the people who do drink sodas is 2 a day, 24 ounces a day, roughly.
So has that changed at all over the last few decades?
Well, if you can believe it, it's gone down. One of the remarkable trends in American diets is that soda consumption, which started going up dramatically in the early 1980s and reached a peak in the late 1990s, has been falling ever since and has gone down by 20% to 25%, something that the soda industry attributes to health advocacy.
So how does that compare to soda consumption in other countries?
Well, it depends on which country. Mexico has a per capita consumption that's somewhere equivalent to ours, and so does Argentina. But countries like India and China drink practically none. And so those are the target markets for soda marketing these days.
And we'll certainly talk more about marketing, but let's go back to that figure. You said that the per capita average is 30 gallons a day, but you said about half of the people don't drink any soda at all.
No, it's 30 gallons a year.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah,
a day would be really horrifying, wouldn't it?
Yeah, 10 to 12 ounces a day.
So who is it? You said half of the population is not drinking any at all. Who is drinking all that soda?
Well, the soda industry can lay that out very clearly, and the people who drink the most soda tend to be young men, people who do not have much education, who don't have much money, who have blue-collar jobs, less than a high school education, the lower the socioeconomic status, the more sodas are consumed. And it's not an accident that that's where so much of the targeted marketing goes.
And is there a racial component to that as well?
Yeah, low-income minorities drink the most soda, and the targeted marketing goes to low-income African-Americans and Hispanics.
We're talking with Marion Nessel. She's a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. Her most recent book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. Now, Marion, what are some of the health concerns that are related to drinking soda?
Well, the big one is the amount of sugar that they contain. From a public health standpoint, sodas are what we call low-hanging fruit. They're an easy target because they contain sugars, water, flavors, but have no redeeming nutritional value. High diets that are high in sugar are associated with weight gain, obesity, poor diets in general, heart disease, type 2 diabetes is the big one. And there are studies that show that soda consumption is independently associated with those conditions, but there's even more suggestion that soda consumption is correlated with obesity, which is correlated with those conditions. Obviously, people who drink sodas eat other foods, so it's very hard to attribute whatever the problems are to just that one food.
And do we have a sense of what kind of financial costs there are that come with those soda-related health issues?
Well, obesity alone is hundreds of billions of dollars a year. I've seen estimates ranging from 200 to 800 billion, depending on how they count that. But that counts for healthcare costs and lost productivity. And there have been estimates of the contribution of soda to those costs, but I'm not sure I take them very seriously. They're based on a lot of estimations. The numbers are big.
Now, certainly we've heard a lot about artificial sweeteners in the past years, whether they're safe or in what quantities, but you're really focusing on the sugar soft drinks. Why is that?
Well, it has calories, and the artificial sweeteners don't, and people drink much, much more sugar-sweetened beverage than they do of the diet sodas. Diet sodas in the United States are maybe a third, less than a third, of total soda of carbonated beverage consumption. And it's interesting about diet sodas that there's very little evidence that they help people maintain or control weight. People who drink diet sodas seem to make up for the missing calories by eating calories from other sources. And in fact, one of the big disappointments this week is that the CDC has just come out with new data on obesity prevalence. And it shows that the prevalence of obesity in the United States is going up a little bit. And that's very disappointing because both sodas and sugar consumption has been on a decline for the last 10 years. And you would hope that that would show up in some kind of leveling off of obesity rates. They have leveled off in children, but not in adults.
So there's little doubt that Americans get a lot of extra calories in their diets from a range of different products. But you write about the calories in soda that create particular problems. What is it about those calories that are in soda that are so problematic in the human body?
Well, it's the sugars. And it's what's fascinating to me is the amount of sugar in sodas. I just can't get my head around it. There's roughly a teaspoon of sugar in sugars, plural, because most of it is high fructose corn syrup, but of sugars in every ounce of soda. It's actually 5/6 of an ounce. 5/6 of a teaspoon per ounce, but let's call it, we'll round it up and call it a teaspoon. That means if you have a 12-ounce soda, you've got 10 to 12 teaspoons. If you've got a 20-ounce soda, you've got 16 or 18 teaspoons of sugars in there. That's a lot to take in at any one time. If you were sitting there with a glass of water putting cubes or packets of sugar in, it would be like taking a glucose tolerance test. And the body's not equipped to handle that amount of sugar absorbed through the intestine that quickly. It just does all kinds of things to hormonal balances and our ability to handle the calories that we're consuming. It's much healthier to eat sugars in the form of solid food than it is in liquid food, it appears, just simply because of how quickly it gets absorbed.
Certainly in the public health campaigns around smoking, there's been a strong recognition of the addictive qualities of cigarettes. Is there any proof that soda is addictive?
Well, there's certainly suggestions. Proof is too strong, I think. There are people who feel that they're addicted to sodas. There are people who feel that they're addicted to diet sodas. And they exhibit many of the same symptoms that people who are addicted to more harmful things exhibit. They crave the substance. They feel deprived of it when they don't have it. They will do anything that they possibly can in order to get it. Sugars affect the same pleasure centers as do psychoactive drugs and cigarettes and those kinds of things, although not nearly to the same extent. So I think the addiction issue is being argued, and I don't think it's settled, but there certainly are suggestions in that direction.
So another similarity to tobacco control efforts is your examination of marketing done on behalf of the soda industry. An interview with you by the Center for Science and the Public Interest claimed that soda sells happiness and other emotions as opposed to the product itself. Why would you say that?
Well, I just came back from a trip to Coca-Cola World in Atlanta, and the visit there, which you have to pay $16 to get into, starts out with a video that had everybody in tears. Even I was sort of trickling because it's so absolutely touching. What Coca-Cola sells is love, happiness, and great moments in people's lives, many of which are deeply touching, and you're to celebrate them with sodas. You don't think about the health effects or anything else connected with that. So I ended up thinking that Coca-Cola is a schizophrenic company. On the one hand, you have its public face, which is selling love, happiness, and wonderful moments. And on the other hand, you have the behind-the-scenes people who are making every one of those decisions very strategically in order to get people to have brand loyalty and to want to drink more of the product and to think it's normal and wonderful to drink it all day long.
We're talking with Marion Nessel about her latest book, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. And we want to hear from you. Do you support efforts to regulate the food and beverage industry more closely with the hopes of improving public health? Does soda consumption concern you personally? If you're a parent, do you worry about how much soda your child drinks? Join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation now with Marion Nessel about her latest book. It's called Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. And we want to hear from you on this. Where do you think the balance is between individual freedom and public health? Would you support having the beverage industry more closely regulated? And if you would, what would you like to see put in place? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post your comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Marion, there are many people who feel strongly that adults should be able to buy whatever food and beverages they want to in whatever quantities they want. How do you respond to those concerns about limiting soft drinks?
Well, I think the government is already deeply involved in food choices, and we currently have a food environment that promotes certain kinds of diets and makes certain foods cheaper than others, and in many, many ways makes it possible for people to eat one way rather than another without any concern about health at all. Health is something that we all share in equally. If our healthcare system is overwhelmed by people who have type 2 diabetes, which is just an awful disease for individuals, but it's also an awful disease for society because the healthcare costs are so great. We live in a society in which we all need to help each other with these things. And as it turns out, if measures against sodas, like the Berkeley soda tax, for example, was clearly tied to using the revenues for purposes that everybody could get behind, in this case, child health initiatives, It sailed through, and both conservative and liberal people voted for it. I think there's real bipartisan support for trying to do social programs that will help everybody.
Yet, on the other hand, New York City, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg really brought this issue into the public eye when he tried to limit the size of soft drinks that could be sold in his city, and that did not go nearly as well.
No, and I think it didn't go well because I live in New York City, so I got to watch this in action. The proposal violated basic rules of food advocacy. If you're going to do food advocacy, the first thing you have to do is to have allies. And no attempt whatsoever was made to recruit allies in advance of the announcement, so that it came as kind of a surprise to everybody and nobody had much time to think about it. The Bloomberg administration was shocked that the African American and Hispanic communities supported the soda industry in its fight against the soda cap. And yet when people talked to people in those communities later, they said, well, nobody ever came to talk to us about it. And that's violating rule number one. You can't expect to just dump these things and have everybody get behind them. You need to do a lot of work to explain what this is about, especially in a situation where the burden of type 2 diabetes and the diseases that go with soda consumption are borne more by the African American and Hispanic communities than they are by the white communities.
So, Marion, the title of your book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. You did say that soda consumption has gone down since the peak in the late 1990s. Who is it in that title of your book that is taking on Big Soda?
Well, there are an enormous numbers of advocacy organizations that are using sodas as an example of where you can use public policy to create healthier food environments. I can't even count the number of groups, the number of cities, the number of statewide initiatives, the number of public health campaigns that are using this as the first line of something that you can do for your health that really isn't very difficult to do. So there are lots and lots of substitute water campaigns, of drink water, not soda, of attempts to remove sodas from schools, remove sodas from workplaces, and just try to create an environment where there are healthy, where there are healthier beverages around. And many of these are quite successful.
A caller, Jeremy, who couldn't stand the line, actually did say, we don't need the government to get involved with soda regulation. Kids are learning about sugary soda in schools. Jeremy said that his 7-year-old told him that he'd never have a soda because it's bad for you. So it sounds like there are some strong educational efforts. Is that enough, or does it need to go along with regulation?
Well, I think both will help. I mean, not every school is doing that. That's really wonderful. Somebody is really taking that on. So that's what I meant by an example of a school district that is dealing with the issue and trying to get children more interested in drinking healthier beverages. And if they can set up that habit, that's going to be a lifetime habit. Now, sodas aren't poison. Nobody's concerned about having a small one once in a while as a treat. It's drinking them as a replacement for water that's such a big concern, again, because of the extraordinary amount of sugar that they contain. So, yes, education works in some situations, but it works better if it's accompanied by policies, because policies make it easier for people to make those kinds of choices.
We're talking with Marion Nessel about her latest book, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. And let's go to the phones and Dave in Madison. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Great program. First, my confession. I have been a Coca-holic for 40 years. And I'll partially point the finger of blame at my parents, who would never, ever allow soda in the house. So the moment I left for college, there was suddenly Coca-Cola, the nice big 16-ounce bottles in my room. And I've always found ways to justify drinking plenty of Coca-Cola. Now I'm at the age where I have a heart condition and things, and I know I shouldn't be drinking it because of the soda or the sugar and the caffeine. What do you recommend as some good possible options for trying to get off this?
Thanks for that. Why don't you try the 7.5-ounce cans? And try to limit yourself to one of them and just cut down less frequently and in smaller portions would be my advice if it's something that you just don't feel that you can give up. And you need to make sure that the rest of your diet is healthy.
Thanks for that call, Dave.
Well, good luck with it.
Yeah, it's probably, like any habit, it's not easy to change. Marion, in just the minute or so we have left, what does success look like in this battle? Is it different labeling? Is it restrictions, limits on size? What will you define as success?
Well, I would define it as not thinking that drinking sodas all day long is normal, especially for children. To make sugar-sweetened beverages treats, once in a while treats, not everyday fare, and to look at these drinks as liquid candy. And, you know, you wouldn't feed candy to kids all day long, and I don't think sodas should be fed to kids all day long either. Again, not removing them completely, but giving them a very different place in the diet, something similar to the place that candy has. And the soda industry is well aware of all of this, and they are making healthier beverages. They're promoting the use of these small cans and doing other things that I think will help people with that.
Marion, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Marion Nessel. She's a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and a professor of sociology at New York University. Her most recent book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning.